From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Julie Coslow didn't set out to be the first woman anything. She has known for years about a penchant for the spiritual world, and that understanding crystallized during a deeply personal experience that we'll hear about today. But regardless of intention, in 2015, Rabbi Julie Coslow became the spiritual leader of B'nai Israel congregation after Rabbi Robert Waxman retired, the first woman rabbi in Wilmington, North Carolina. And she gained this unsought distinction while seeing what has been a long-held dream unfold in her life. She's with us today to talk about the journey that has led her here, the challenges she still faces, and why she says it's time for the Jewish people to turn outward. Rabbi Julie Coslow, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you, Rachel. It's an honor to be here. Thank you.
And we're inviting your questions on this Thursday. Is there a question you've always wanted to ask a rabbi or this rabbi? Now is your chance. You can reach us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Rabbi Coslow, this experience you had, you characterized this as a personal encounter with the creator of the universe when you were giving birth at 27 years old. How did that experience contribute to launching you on the path of becoming a rabbi?
You know, every time I hear somebody else say it back to me, it's a little unnerving because it sounds so kitschy. It sounds so, oh, she had an amazing spiritual experience and met God. But quite honestly, that's exactly what happened. So, and it was 33 years ago. So I think that whatever propelled me there was something real enough that it was going to propel me through these past 33 years.
Can you describe it? Can you describe how it felt and what you saw, experienced?
Well, I can actually describe it through a folk tale, a Jewish folk tale. I feel, first of all, there are many women, not all by any means, but there are many women who, when they give birth, do have very, very powerful spiritual experiences. So that part does make sense to me. But there's a very old Jewish folktale where Adam says to God, what are we doing here? What's going on in this world? And God says, listen, it's for me to know and for you to find out. And Adam just won't take that as the sole answer. And he bugs. What's going on here? What's going on here? And God gets so fed up with the nagging that God says, okay, listen, Adam, I'm going to give you one split second, and you're going to be able to see from the beginning of creation to the end of creation. And just one split second. But after that, you've got to be no more. That's it. That's all I'm going to give you. And God gives Adam this view from the beginning of creation to the end, and he then knows all the secrets. I felt in a way that when I gave birth, I was given that same view. So if I could translate it into what that looked like to me spiritually, that there was a massive table the size of the universe, and on it were millions of little pieces of puzzle pieces. And I knew that I was charged, as we all are as human beings, to find our piece of that puzzle and with every fiber of our being fit that piece of puzzle into creation. And the piece of puzzle that called me was to be a leader among the people of which I'm a part of, the Jewish people, and to carry the essential, profound messages that created that people through to the next generation in strength.
But you were not raised in a household that was very religious. They were very proudly Jewish.
Right, to say the least. I say to people, the Sabbath is a central doctrine and belief in our tradition. If somebody had said to me when I was, you know, growing up in my home or even in my teens, I'll give you $5 million if you tell me what the Sabbath is, I would have had to lose the money. I would not have known that's how ignorant, how much apathy there was in my home. But it's very interesting because we had a very strong sense of Jewish identity, but it manifested more culturally. My parents, I call them social justice Jews. They felt that if they were doing good work in the world, they were good Jews. And there are many Jews still living like that, and I honor them, but that wasn't what was calling me at the time when I feel that I was being called to serve.
There are different degrees of that. Did you celebrate Passover in your house?
Passover was absolutely celebrated. It was the greatest pomp and ceremony. What was not there, when I look back, was there were no candles lit at the beginning with a prayer that is usually said. So it was the Seder was said, but there was very little, I don't think, many Jews really get what's going on, so I worked very hard as I led the Seder for 85 of my wonderful congregants on Monday night. I do a lot of explaining and attempting to make these issues very relevant because there's, and this is not just in Judaism, there is just a lot of apathy in our world about all the things we call ourselves. And I'm into teaching so that you know what you are, you know why you are what you are, and that you're part of who you are instead of just by default calling yourself a name.
One of the observations that I've made about you after having, this is the second time that we've met,
yes,
is you appear to have an extraordinary amount of personal clarity about what you're doing and why you're doing it, and an extraordinary self-awareness. You're aware of conflicting feelings and thoughts, and instead of trying to push away the conflict, you seem to welcome it. Did that have anything to do with having a father who lived as an artist? Can you talk about his artistic impulses and the impression that made on you?
Okay, remind me to go there. But first, I want to say something about that, the contradiction there. Judaism at its best is about, in my opinion, walking a tightrope where you have to have opposing ideas in each hand and you have to navigate through life. It's one of the reasons I love Judaism so much, because it's much more about the questions than it ever is about the answers. Why? Because in our human capacity, we know that we cannot find with the limitations of our own brains and hearts and souls as they manifest in this world, we cannot find the answers to reconcile. Our faith is in a God and a creator who's got all that ability and is reconciling everything. And that's where we have to have faith. And I do have that faith. I'm comfortable knowing that I don't know all the answers. I don't know most of the answers, but I do know the questions. And that to me is how to live in the most passionate way, and I would say as a rabbi to my Jewish congregants, the most passionate Jewish way to live is to find a way to try and navigate balancing contradictions and dichotomies in life and walking with them both together. So that's about that. When you asked me this question, what I got from my father, who was an amazing artist, this was a God-given talent. You look at his artwork and you're going, no human being could create that.
And he lived as an artist.
And he lived as an artist. Very unusual. My father never had to work for anyone. He just painted art and sold it and raised a family of four children, traveled all over the world. They would rent their home in Detroit, Michigan for a year, and we'd go live in Mallorca or Mexico or San Miguel de Allende or Puerto Rico or England. We lived, and then he would paint for a year and then ship all of his artwork back to Detroit, where he had the reputation of being a Detroit artist. And he was able to live a magnificent life that way. What I do, my father used to talk to us about the art world at the time was very, it was in the hands of the gay world. And my father was not gay. And I remember he used to tell us about how he just didn't play the game, whatever that was. So I'm telling you where I relate to my father. He didn't play the game. He just was who he was. And people used to say to him, you know, Richard, if you would play the game a little bit, you'd make millions of dollars. You know, he made plenty of money. But if you just learned how to play the game, you would make so much more money. And my dad couldn't play games. That's what I got from my father.
He also must have had a deep respect for his own artistic imperative, his inner voice, which is what you appear to have for your own.
Yes, that comes from my father without question. He did, and the confidence he had. Now, I have that confidence as well, but I will tell you, since we're talking about the fact that my gender is female, my confidence, of course, through the process of learning has been rattled to its core. In the end, I'm not going to say in the end because the end is not here yet, I feel right now extremely confident and strong, but I know exactly where the pitfalls are, and I know where the dangers are, and I know what a vicarious, not vicarious, but what a dangerous walk we have to walk. Where my father, you know, I mean, for him, it was just a little different world. He was a great artist. He was very esteemed for that, and he was just going to do it his own way. And I think that is absolutely something. There are times where I'll say, Julie, just keep your mouth shut. And I cannot for the life of me, because it's just integral to who I am and my destiny as a rabbi.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. We're talking with Rabbi Julie Koslow of B'nai Israel in Wilmington, North Carolina on this Thursday. If you have your own question for the rabbi, you can give us a call at 910-343-1138 or send us an email at coastline@whqr.org. The phone lines are now open. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Rabbi Julie Koslow of B'nai Israel in Wilmington, North Carolina is our guest today. She has the distinction of being the first female rabbi in Wilmington, and we're talking with her today about her path to the rabbinate and, yes, the role her gender plays, both for her and for the public, and why she doesn't want to be defined by that. And the rabbi is taking your questions on this Thursday. You can call us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Rabbi Koslow, just before we went to break, you talked about the influence that your father had on you and how he was a very successful artist in his own right. You grew up, got married, made a deal with your husband.
Yes,
tell us about that deal.
Youth, how idealistic we. Well, yes, I got married when I was 22, which was way too young. And our promise was the first decade would be for my ex-husband, and the second decade would be for me. So the first decade was to help get his doctorate in economics, his studies taken care of, and then get on his way into his career, and then get a career underway. The second, and I wanted to have children, so that would be my time to have our children, and everything went according to plan. The second decade would be that we would focus our attention on my dreams, which was to study to become a rabbi, which is no small feat. It's not an easy thing to say, well, I'm going to become a rabbi.
This was a dream of yours then.
Well, from the time my first child was born, I just knew, you know, I'm a leader. My personality is a leader. So when I had my awakening, let's say at that time, I just knew that the end game was going to be as high as the leadership ladder would allow me. So I was aware of being driven to be a rabbi for a good decade, if not more.
And so, so then you knew that the second decade of your marriage would be about the two of you supporting your path.
Right.
To and, becoming a rabbi.
And everyone knew that. So we lived in three different, my children were born in three different countries. My ex-husband's work took us to different different countries. And in each country, I became the rabbi of that town we lived in. I started teaching the children. You know, I had my, I have the personality where if somebody's got something deep to tell someone, they're going to tell me. and they also know how much I cherish and honor them. So it's a safe place to share what goes on. But, excuse me, the whole world knew that I was destined to be a rabbi and that that was
And then going it, to happen. It didn't quite unfold that way.
Well, of course, we say that humans plan and God laughs. I don't like to put God into such a mean light. So I would say God goes, no, 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 it's just not going to work that way. I'm so sorry. Of course, divorce happened when it was just about my turn. So the painful aspect of that was that I had to find a way to raise my three children alone, three adolescent children in Los Angeles, California. Finish up a bachelor's degree and a master's degree, get into rabbinic school, and spend 7 years in graduate school, which is what it took for me. And then
getting into rabbinic school was not easy by itself.
No, getting into rabbinic school is not an easy feat, and I was very proud that I did. I moved with my children to Los Angeles because that was the school that I knew. Because I thought the school was great, but it also my options were New York City, and I just it would have Los Angeles is much more user friendly for a single parent. I could have gotten home in 12 minutes, and if the 405 was filled, I would have I knew how to get home anyways. I knew the back streets.
Why do you think that it was harder for you as a woman to get into rabbinic school than it would have been for a man with the same qualifications, the same test scores, the same everything else?
Oh, that's such a tricky one to answer. So the answer is yes, but it's I believe it's very unconscious. So I know that the rabbis who let me in would deny it. But we have systems which are deeply entrenched that don't have places for women. So bringing women in is going to be an interesting experiment. So I believe it's harder for us to get in. I believe it's harder for us to stay in. And once we get out, we know that we're not going to get the same jobs that the men do. We know it, or we should know it. Maybe I didn't know it. I figured it out. For me, it was fine because I've always wanted to be. My dream was to be a small town rabbi. I want to know the names and faces of all of my congregants. I want to know who's suffering. I want to know who's about to have a. I want to know. I really want to be an integral part of my congregation's life. A lot of people in rabbinic school who want to become rabbis, that's not their goal. They want to be the leader, teacher. they hope to manifest different. I'm a people person, and I really like to be on the ground level of people's lives. So the big jobs in the cities where it's still, at least in the movement, the conservative movement that I align myself with, women are not, very few women, I'm not saying they are, there aren't, but for the most part, we don't get those jobs.
And at the time, when you were divorced, raising three kids by yourself in Los Angeles. So you were also having to support yourself because part of this history is that your ex-husband wasn't really trying to make it easy for you to accomplish this. In fact, you even might say he set out to make sure that you couldn't become a rabbi.
Well,
Would you go that far?
I would say he's a very good father, and he always paid his child support. What he didn't want to pay was alimony, which is what I really needed. And you know what? He was very hurt that I asked for a divorce. And he said to me once, and he meant it, I'm gonna take your kids away and I'm going to stop you from becoming a rabbi. And all I can say is that he didn't succeed. And I thank God for it every day. But yeah, it was very, very challenging to be a single parent working four jobs, a full-time graduate student. Those years were a nightmare. I don't know how I can say it any better. I never stopped moving. I never let despair sweep over me. When I look back now, I am absolutely flabbergasted. I have no idea how I made it. I have no idea. But I did, and I'm very proud of it. If I had to do it again, you know, I could do it easier now. I would have known, was I as good a parent as I as I wish I could have been under all the pressure I had? No, I wasn't. You know, school, I got A's. I got all A's. I don't know exactly how I did that.
When you think about your ex-husband and all of the rather vicious-sounding things he did, I mean, this is a person who acknowledged that he was trying to stop you from raising your own kids and doing the one thing in your life that you felt you were meant to do. So that's pretty vicious. That's my word. But when you think about that, as a spiritual leader now, as a woman of God, as a teacher, how do you reconcile that? Have you forgiven him? Can you? Is that part of it? And what is forgiveness in this case?
You know, I think how it has strengthened me is that when somebody comes into my office and says, I'm going through a divorce, or I think I have to get a divorce, or I'm several years out of a divorce and I'm still suffering, I know exactly what that person is talking about, and I can really help. And I can help in a way that I wished I had somebody who could have helped me, because when you're in the middle of that, along with so many other traumas in life, but when you're in the middle of it, you cannot see clearly. So it has empowered me to be a better rabbi, a more compassionate and empathetic human being. And I like to say that I can see pain coming a mile away. And it's been, in many ways, I am a blessed rabbi that I've had a lot of challenge and suffering in my life, because it has, first of all, allowed me to stand in front of people and say, look, stay the steady course. You're going to be okay. Nobody has to stay in those broken places forever. You can make it. I can show them that with my life. But there's an authenticity to coming to me with problems, because I have experienced many of them. And when it comes to forgiveness, all I can say about that is I had to learn that my ex-husband, who let me down in terrible ways, was probably in so much pain that I ended that marriage, that he acted out in the most horrible, terrible ways. And that is my only focus now. Not how he did it, but how sad I feel for him that he was not able to remain a good, kind, loving person because he was in too much pain. And that's all I'll say about that.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a conversation with Rabbi Julie Koslow of B'nai Israel in Wilmington. We're learning about her journey to the rabbinate and why she says it's time for the Jewish people to turn outward in the world. You can reach us to ask your own question on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Nicole from Wilmington, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're
Hi,
welcome. Nicole. Go ahead.
So I just had a question. I was raised in a Protestant family, and I've always kind of battled with this biblical question about God. We talk about how God is an all-knowing, he's all-knowing, and yet it seems that in the Bible, in different stories, he changes his mind. And in the story or the parable that you were talking about earlier, how he finally showed Adam the split second after Adam persisted, it seems like God changed his mind. But if he's all-knowing, wouldn't he already know that that was the end result?
You're asking an age-old question. How much does God know, and how much responsibility do we have to take if God knew to begin with? So I can only speak for this rabbi's perspective of God's omnipotence. In Judaism, we have just about every possible response, and we respect the different responses. I believe that for there to be any integrity to the human endeavor whatsoever, there has to be human choice. And Judaism is very strong about believing that God says to us, you have a choice, now make the right ones. And I actually think a human being's life is just a concession, millions of little choices, and who you're going to be at the end of your life is only all the choices you have made. Only, I don't mean in a diminished way, but you are every choice you've ever made. I do not believe that God, I believe that God gives us the choice, and then we have to find our way, given the choices we've made. And I do not believe that God knows everything that's going to happen. And I'll tell you why. That, to me, would make God complicit in all the evil and suffering on the planet. If God knows that's going to happen, God needs not to create a world where so much suffering is happening. And I don't believe that God ever would. I believe God is pure and utter love. That's all God is. So we human beings have to stumble through and find our way. And I think God is cheering from the sidelines at all times, please make the right choice. And sometimes we can, and sometimes we can't. And then we have to continue to strive to be the best human beings we can, given our good and our bad choices in life.
Nicole, thank you so much for your question. It's a conversation with Rabbi Julie Koslow of B'nai Israel in Wilmington. And you can ask your own question on this Thursday by calling us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. We had a call earlier. George from Wilmington asked, would Rabbi Koslow care to comment on the origins of anti-Semitism? How did it all start?
Yeah, I would love to comment on the origins of anti-Semitism. I believe the origins of anti-Semitism came because there was a group of people who just didn't believe what the belief of the day was. And that was the new Christian faith, which had grown out of its parent religion, Judaism. And we Jews are just have and will always stay the steady course in our belief system. And of course, with the birth of Christianity, there was a need. I don't think it's a real need, but they believed it was a need to have everybody believe for them to feel confident in their belief system. And we were not going to get on board with that because we don't believe that. We just don't believe that a human being can be the Messiah. It's just not possible. It's not possible for Jews to reconcile that. We're very comfortable with the message we have from God. So we have stayed true to our faith. And I think that slowly there was a love-hate war with the Jewish people, and that God obviously loves the Jewish people. You can read this in the Torah and the Bible. And yet we're now saying that the Christian world was then saying that they were no longer the chosen people. Now God has brought God's Son, that God changed God's mind and brought God's Son. And we Jewish people just still believe the way we've always believed and are always going to believe that way. So I think in a way it starts in that, you know, that terrible inability for many human beings to hold those two contradictions in the same soul and say, this is what we believe, it's not what they believe, and still to love your fellow human being, which is, that's one of the foundational blocks of my rabbinate. I have no right to ask anybody to be anything, only to love them the best that I can. So I think that was the very early on seeds. And then history being what it was, we became the scapegoat through the Middle Ages. And when, scapegoats happen all the time. And we were a people who were going to take the fall for a lot of the problems in the different societies throughout the Middle Ages, and we were frankly tortured for it. Terrible, terrible, terrible violence and cruelty for being different. So It's an important question today because in the political climate we're in, you know, we Jews are a little safer today because I think that those who would tend to be on the hating side are going to vent towards Hispanics and Blacks and gays. But I remind my congregants, you know, we're not off that table. We're just at the bottom of the list now. But we're still on there. If somebody's going to hate, they will hate those who are different. And we are different.
In light of that, you still say it's time to heal from the Holocaust. That wasn't very long ago. When you're looking at it through the lens of all of human history, that was yesterday. And yet you're saying it's time. You're not advocating forgetting, but you're saying it is time to heal those wounds and pick up and move on. What do you mean by that?
Well, I don't know if I would ever say heal those wounds. That's not exactly what I mean. These are wounds which I'm not sure there is such a thing as healing. What I will say and what I do believe is post-Holocaust, which we've been in for the last 70 years, is a frightened state. And how could it be anything else? You know, Adolf Hitler tortured to death 6 million of our people because he didn't like us. We were vibrant, active people in a society not unlike our society today, and we were denigrated and put in ovens and tortured to death. We haven't even really begun to make sense of the cruelty of what took place. What I'm saying is that I feel that Judaism was so traumatized post-Holocaust that in many ways our religious institutions and our religion became pediatric in a way. Like, I feel as though rabbis must have been scared. What's going to happen if people ask, you know, oh, I have to wrap this.
Yes, and we're going to come back to this. Okay. This doesn't mean we will absolutely come back to this and let you finish this point.
Okay.
Too complicated to let it go.
You're
listening to Coastline. When we come back from this break, it'll also be your last chance to ask your own question of Rabbi Julie Koslow. You can call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. You're listening to Coastline. You are listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. We're talking today with Rabbi Julie Koslow of B'nai Israel in Wilmington, North Carolina. Rabbi Koslow has the distinction, whether she wants it or not, of being the first female rabbi in the city of Wilmington. After Rabbi Robert Waxman retired from B'nai Israel in 2015, Rabbi Koslow took over as spiritual leader. And we're talking with her today about her path to the rabbinate, the challenges women still face in 2017. And before we went to break, we were talking about the Holocaust and how Rabbi Koslow feels the Jewish people need to perhaps not heal the wounds, but move forward from this. So you were saying, Rabbi Koslow.
I'll just wrap this up because this is very complicated. It's not heal the wounds. I feel that we've certainly been licking the wounds, right? We've been in a state which is a very, how could you expect anything else? But our destiny as Jews is to be an Or LaGoyim, a light unto the nations of justice and all that God wants most from the human race, which is just the highest level of ethics and morality. And, you know, we've been, I think, a little scared. And I'm speaking in a very broad sense of the sort of psyche of our people. And I feel now it's time for us to stand up. We're okay. We need to stand up and step out and continue to remind the world, you know, of all the work that needs to be done to repair this world. That is really the message of the Jewish people. So I'm not, it's such a sacred thing, the suffering of the Holocaust. I don't feel we need to get over it. I don't believe in that concept. It's sort of a kitschy modern way of, you know, diminishing somebody's pain in one way or another. Now I'm not interested in that. And I think we need to really look at what happened and how it happened and how to prevent that from happening, not only to us, but to all peoples on the planet and where terrible things are happening, and to try and, you know, broaden it and make it more universal So I'm just saying that it's time for us to come out of hiding a bit. We've got work to do, and that is really what our destiny is. So that's what I meant to say on that.
And you characterized I don't know if you meant the practice of Judaism today as pediatric as a result of the fear.
Well, no, I just think that I imagine being a rabbi in the 50s and being terrified that somebody's going to come and say, how could God let that happen to our people? And of course, everybody was traumatized. What could you say? So I think that Judaism in many synagogues became very pediatric. It focused on the kids, and it focused on sort of shallow messages. One of my greatest jobs is to, you know, to bring into my synagogue the incredible spiritual depth of Judaism. It is not just about, you know, little holidays and have fun and dip apples in honey and sing a song. It is, in my opinion, one of, if not the greatest spiritual discipline ever, ever found on this planet. And that's what I'm bringing my congregation, something that can transform a human soul to live a life beyond their imagination of goodness.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. It's a conversation with Rabbi Julie Koslow of B'nai Israel in Wilmington. You can ask your own question on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. Matthew from Myrtle Beach, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thanks. What's your question, Matthew?
Well, I'm Jewish myself. I'm from Israel. I live in the States for about 12 years. I've been traveling the world a lot. And the one thing that I've noticed that a lot of rabbis and priests and very influential Muslim people are doing is keeping that image of God, even though we all know that God is everything and everything is God. And we keep separating ourselves from other people, from humankind. So saying that Jewish people, Christian people, Muslim people, we're just separating each other and we're causing world wars for centuries and centuries. So how come we never admit the fact that God is actually everything and everything is God, and it's not an invisible man in the sky that watches us and separates everything and causes war?
So you say your name is Matthew?
Yeah.
And you're from Israel and your name is Matthew?
Yeah, my name is Matan.
Matan.
Make it easier for
Matan.
Everybody.
Okay, Matan. That's a beautiful name. Matan, you're not hanging out at my synagogue. Come and hang out at my synagogue. I don't say those things. I don't believe in separating peoples. I don't believe in separating genders. I don't believe in the separation. We are all echad. We are all one. The human race is one. And it's an idea which we are just at the threshold of some human beings being able to even comprehend what that might mean. And if you heard me sermonize, I don't think you would throw me into that crowd.
Matan, have you heard separation in this conversation?
Of course. As soon as we address the Holocaust as something that happened only to Jewish people, we're separating. There was 70 million people that died in World War II, and we look at it as a Holocaust. When we talk about what happened to the Jewish people in the past or what will happen now, or she was saying that we were in the bottom of the hated people, even though they hate Muslims and black people and gay people more now, still, that to me is all.
So please let me reiterate. I said that the haters now, this is what I said, if they want to hate, they're going to manifest their hatred first now towards Hispanics and then to blacks and then to gays. We're at the bottom. We're luckier now. They're not coming after us right now. They will come after the others first. So I was actually saying I actually said the opposite of what you claimed I said.
Matan?
Actually, I don't see any haters. I see myself in them. If a person even approaches to kill me, it's still a part of me. We're all one in this universe.
Yes, we are. Yes, we are.
Mm-hmm. It's all one energy. So to me, it's still, but I understand that you can't approach any subject without, kind of separating, so I take it back to
life. No. I appreciate what you say, and I that is a part of my rabbinate, that understanding of oneness without question. But I am a rabbi, and my job is to care for the Jewish people. And so that, especially in this conversation, that is what I've been asked to speak on.
And that separation right there, because we need to take care of all people.
Okay. Matan Todah Rabah.
I do take care of all people.
And let's talk about another element of that, because we've talked about the gender distinction, but we haven't really gotten into how it manifests for you today in 2017 as a female rabbi. But it does, and you see it.
Yeah, I mean, I first want to say, because you've said it every introduction,
yes,
she doesn't want to be, you know, she's doesn't want to be seen as a female rabbi. So I it's not that. It's that when I was called to the rabbinate, which has really been a whole life's journey, I didn't hear God in my ear saying, Julie, I want you to be a lady rabbi. I was just called to serve in the capacity of a teacher, of a parent, of a spiritual guide. So for me, it just feels funny when I am designated as a lady rabbi. I'm very proud to be the first rabbi in Wilmington who's a woman. I think that's what a privilege, an absolute privilege. So I don't diminish that at all. I just, it doesn't. And I'm sure there are parts of how I rabbi which are very different. I know that's true because I'm a woman, because I'm a mother, because, you know, men and women live very different experiences, and I bring those experiences to my rabbinate.
You bring your femaleness to it. Yes.
I absolutely
do. And you do acknowledge that.
I do acknowledge that, but what I would say is that my determination, my drive, my all the things that if you saw on about me on paper and they didn't say my gender, you would have thought I was a man. So I don't think that's real either. I think that men and women are much more alike than they are different. We all need and want the same things. It's just we expect men to be strong and we expect women to be a little bit more passive. And I'm both of those things. I'm strong and I'm passive. I don't fit into any one of the boxes. So what people think and people have said to me, I didn't know a female rabbi would be A, B, or C. Well, I'm like, you know, I wish we were just saying, wow, what does your rabbinate look like?
Right.
Instead of trying to align it to my gender, which I honestly don't think. I mean, of course, it has something to do with how I rabbi, but it has nothing to do with being called to the rabbinate to serve the Jewish people in this capacity.
So can you talk about how that shows up?
You know, the main way it shows up is that these systems have been in place forever, how we look at each other, how we understand each other, how we judge each other. So when a woman walks in the door and is doing something completely different than what you thought a woman could do, whether you know it or not, you have a reaction, and whether you know it or not, that person can feel that reaction. And that's not going to go away until so much time has passed where it's not surprising or shocking anymore, you know, to see women doing jobs that for all of the human experience, women were not considered, allowed. It wasn't even a thought that a woman would be in those positions. To think that these kind of deep, profound ways of looking at each other would just disappear because somebody finally said, okay, we'll let women into rabbinic schools, it just doesn't make sense. It's going to take a long time for us to wipe away. And it's not just for men. There are many women, you know, I think some of my toughest critics are women, not men, because, you know, here you have a woman doing something that most women have not ever considered doing or ever thought that that was something that they would, could, should do.
Is there a coalition of clergy people in this area who gets together from different faith disciplines, talks? And is your femaleness a factor in that? Is this a difficult place to go?
Well, I'm aware of one, and to tell you that I haven't had an issue with one of the clergy who I think is quite uncomfortable with my strength and ability to speak my mind. To tell you that there haven't been little bumps in the road, that would not be telling you the truth. Yeah, it's tough. There are many people like, okay, if you're going to be a rabbi who's a woman, at least act the way we want you to act. And I'm not considering whether I'm a woman when I have a response. I am going to speak from my brain, my heart, my soul, and the fact that I'm a spiritual leader. And I really couldn't care less what my gender is when I have to comment on something.
And you talk about this. You put it in perspective. You talk about the understanding and how, you know, this sort of, can I use the word, patriarchal approach to all the world religions, how it arose. You learned about that when you were in rabbinic school. And you started to see, you went further. You went beyond the form and into the meaning of it for you. But so you understand it, certainly. But do you, when it comes up, when somebody unwittingly or unconsciously, you know, perpetrates some sort of slight, some sort of sexist or misogynistic slight, and I say unwittingly because that's usually mm-hmm. how it happens.
It is, 99% of the time, yes.
Do you call it out? Or do you step back and smile and say, they just don't know, and move on?
Well, I'm telling you that I 98% of the time, I just let it go. If somebody is not intending to hurt me, how can I expect them to know how to not hurt me? So I think that turned a corner in my life when I didn't have a need to call it out. Now, there are certain things that I speak to my president. A happened. I was very uncomfortable. I'm leaving it alone. If it happens again, I need to come and talk to you about it. So there's a very fine line between having compassion for people who by accident are sticking their foot in your mouth, and that my ego does not say, I've got to be, we've got to rectify this. No, not at all. But then again, I also have a responsibility to be teaching. And sometimes, if something has happened several times, it's important to talk to that person and to say, I know you might not understand how offensive this is. And can I just talk to you about it? And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. The great thing about the political climate we're in now, and I say that, how could there be a great thing? But the great thing about it is that the idea before this political climate came into be, I would say to many people, there's a lot of sexism out there. And people, Americans would say to me, Julie, there is no sexism anymore. Now we know there is. It's been called. We know it's there, and I'm grateful for that. I mean, there's no denying how much sexism, racism, every ism you've got is out there. So I appreciate the fact that now I can talk like this without having people just say to me, "There isn't any sexism," because that's not true. And now we have the courage to say, "No, that's not true. There really is. There's a lot of it, quite mm-hmm. Actually." So.
So we just have a minute or so left, and that's it. Final thought, Rabbi Koslow.
It is such a great honor and a privilege to be one of the change agents, to live at a time where your life can be one of the stepping stones to a better world with more equality for all.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Rabbi Koslow, what a pleasure having you on today.
Thank you, Rachel. The pleasure's all mine.
Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Producer is Isabel Shepherd. Ken Campbell engineered today's show. He's also the technical director. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast on iTunes and check it out on our HQR app. You can also tune in for the rebroadcast, old school, of this episode, Sunday afternoon at 2. Join us for Coastline Live Wednesdays and Thursdays at noon here on HQR News 91.3 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.